welcome to today's episode of the J-Pod, a High Library production. I'm your host, librarian Josh Cohen, speaking to you from Elizabethtown College in Elizabethtown, PA. Today's episode is on the Eton student who helped to solve the cold case of murder victim Maurice Anne Chivarella. I'd like to welcome Eric Schubert to the podcast. Welcome, Eric.
Thank you so much.
Eric was instrumental in helping solve this case, which put him in a national, even an international spotlight. Publications and news media outlets that have covered the story include People Magazine, Good Morning America, CNN, Newsweek, CBC News, which is out of Canada, and the Daily Mail out of UK. Those are just some of them. Eric is a history major pursuing a certificate in public heritage studies with minors in political science and sociology. He's graduating next year. Congrats, Eric, on that.
Thank you.
That's very exciting. I know him primarily from his work as a student assistant at High Library in the Hess Archives. He also works as a student assistant at Eton's Young Center for Anabaptist and Pietist Studies. Eric is the president of the History Club. And in addition to all of those responsibilities, he has a passion for genealogy research, which has led him to successfully solve multiple cold case murders. He most recently helped to solve the 57-year-old cold case murder of Chivarella, an incredible accomplishment. Today we'll be discussing that experience. For listeners not familiar with what happened, Eric successfully helped to solve the case of murder victim Maurice Anne Chivarella earlier this year using genealogy research. I have to warn listeners that some of the details of the case are quite disturbing. In March 1964, Maurice, a 9-year-old girl, was living in a small central PA city called Hazleton, where she was abducted on her way to school. After her body was discovered near a local garbage dump, police determined that she had been sexually assaulted and killed by strangulation. And in the decades that followed, it looked like the case would never be solved. In an article from The Independent about Eric's involvement with the case, Joanna Chisholm noted that, quote, in the 57 years that Chivarella's case remained open, more than 230 members of the police department were involved in the probe at one point or another, amassing more than 4,700 pages in her file without securing a lead on the killer of the young girl, who family members described as being shy with aspirations to become a nun. Using his research skills, Eric was able to zero in on the killer, ultimately identified through DNA matching as James Paul Forte, a bartender who died in 1980. So that's a summary of what I know about the case. Is there anything I got wrong there, Eric, or anything you'd like to clarify?
No, that's a great summary. I mean, it really was an extensive and disturbing case that really impacted a lot of people. It's impacted so many people in so many ways, whether that's law enforcement, you know, families, other people who have worked on it. So, you know, it's important that so many people know how terrible this case was, because I think it's important that they now know that it's solved and they know who committed those terrible things.
So taking a step back for a second from the case, can you tell me about what got you interested in genealogy research? I understand that you got into it from a fairly young, early age.
Yes, I was very young. I was 9, 10 years old. You know, at home, I would usually get sick a lot when I was a kid, so that's when I would be at home, you know, eating ice cream, watching TV, annoying my mother, the typical 9-year-old things you'd be doing if you were sick. It was like clockwork every year, so anytime the winter would roll around, I would say, all right, when's my 2-week vacation going to happen? And so during those just boring times at home, we still argue about it to this day, but either my mother or I suggested somehow, you know, after seeing a commercial online, that, you know, how about you try and do some genealogy research, you know, use up some of your time, search your family tree, that sort of thing. And being a history buff at a young age, and I love puzzles, I thought that was a great idea. But I also thought it would be a 2-3 week thing that would just, you know, be very one-off in how long I did it. But that was 10 years ago, so it's certainly been quite the journey so far.
Interesting. And how did you end up getting involved in this particular case?
So I read about this case in right around when COVID was first happening, so February, March of 2020. And I was reading about the case, and I just saw that about a year or two prior, that they had really tried to dig up some leads. And it showed me that they were clearly trying very hard to, work on this case. So I was reading up on it, and I saw that it looked like they were trying to utilize genealogy. So at that time, I was looking for a way to, help people. I had been doing biological family, research and that sort of thing. And after just seeing this case and hearing that the state police were really actively trying to use genealogy to solve it, I knew that I just had to send an email and say, hey, I'm 18 years old and I'm a college student at E-Town. Here's my background. I always say I like to think I know what I'm doing when it comes to genealogy. If I'm not stepping on anyone's toes, let me know. I'd love to help. So that was, February, March 2020. State police came down, met with me, where I basically convinced them to give me the case. And the rest is history. But I'm so grateful to them for their support and really taking the chance and letting me work on it. But it was really something where I just ran across it, sent an email, thought nothing would happen. And, 2 years later, we got it done.
So what, I'm just curious, because this is such an old case, do you know what had prompted police to decide to start looking back into the case after all that time?
Well, the case was, I was actually told, it's one of the oldest actively investigated cases that the state police worked on. So it was one of those cold cases where, in the 90s they were working on it, in the 2010s they were working on it. So even though it was considered a cold case, the state police never stopped working on this case, and the lead investigators never stopped working on the case. So they told me that my involvement really kickstarted them and reinvigorated them and gave them a lot of hope.
Interesting. So having reached out to the state police, what was that experience like? I mean, I know if it was me, I'd be intimidated contacting the police to see if I could help them. So how did you feel about it?
To me, it was just like, oh, let me send this email and see what happens. The worst that's going to happen is they don't answer me. Yeah. I reached out to every troop has what's called a public information officer, every state police troop. So I reached out to the public information officer up in Hazleton, and that's, when I sent that email. And he got back to me and said, thank you so much, we'll let you know. And I thought, all right, there it goes, nothing's going to happen. And then a day or two later, they said, hey, we would love to come down with, the lead investigator and talk with you. So, it was a little intimidating, but for me, I thought, all right, what's the worst that's going to happen? They say no.
Yeah. So I assume that they were fairly cordial with you.
Oh, they are great. They were great to work with. They were great to talk with, in that initial sort of almost like an interview, because that's what it really was.
A job interview.
It was a job interview. Yeah. So I came prepared like it was a job interview. And at the end of the day, I said, guys, this has been sitting here for, at the time it was 55 years. I said, what do you have to lose letting me work on it? I'm an 18-year-old. I have the time. I love this work. I can, this is what I want to do. Just let me work on the case. So I made my plea to them. And then a few days later, they said, all right, kid, you're up.
Nice. And you worked on this case, as you just mentioned, for 2 years.
2 years.
How many hours were you putting into this?
It certainly varies, would vary week by week. And if, we were doing a lot of stuff, or, if we had some sort of breakthrough. But I would say probably a good estimate is I worked on this case for probably around 20 hours a week, every week, for 18 months to about 2 years.
Wow.
So it was a lot. Yeah. However, I knew that I could get it there, and if I just kept pushing the ball in the right direction, we would get there.
And what was that research process like? I mean, more specifically, how does one solve a 57-year-old or 55-year-old at the time murder case using genealogy?
Yeah, so how this process works is, you see these commercial DNA sites like Ancestry and 23andMe that people use to find biological parents and that sort of thing. And those are extremely popular. It's the same sort of process that I use genetically, sorting through matches and helping people find those parents, as finding a criminal. However, the databases are very different. So it's the same process, but we are using public, open DNA databases that are not very well known to the public, that you really have to go out of your way to upload. So I'm doing the same sort of technique. However, I'm dealing with matches that are very, very distant. And that's all I got. You know, that's what I needed to start the case was, okay, here's a list of a few dozen people who are distantly related to whoever did this. Good luck. So you're just...
Wait, so how do you know they're distantly related to the...
So what they did in, I believe it was 2018, the state police actually had a DNA that was on Maurice's jacket that they had that they had stored for 55 years. And hats off to the original investigators for keeping that and, you know, keeping it in good shape. But what they did in 2018 was they uploaded that to a public DNA database. And they did not have any luck with their research. So all I needed from them was just that list of people, because we had his DNA, we had a list of people he was related to, but it was extremely distant. You know, these are not the type of matches that you would see in a private site like Ancestry or 23andMe. So you're dealing with matches who, you know, your top match could be someone who's four or five generations away. So it's very difficult, but that's a little bit, you know, on how the process goes. So my initial job was to sort through this list, you know, all these people, make family trees, and just try and find connections. You know, if match one and match three are descended from John and Jane Smith 200 years ago, that probably means whoever killed Maurice is also descended from John and Jane Smith, born 200 years ago. So then I go, okay, how many descendants did John and Jane Smith have? I need to find one who was in Hazleton, who had a record. So it's a lot of process of elimination. And my thing was, I just had to cast a very wide net and see what I ended up with. And especially the type of DNA we were dealing with was I saw very early on that it was likely whoever did this was probably first generation American. And that's tricky, because I can't build a family tree out six generations in Italy. You know, it's very difficult. So when I have these, you know, these distant matches and I'm seeing that they're all Italian, to me that showed that he was probably first generation Italian or that sort of thing. But I can't trace the family trees back enough to see those distant connections, if that makes sense. So that's where a lot of the problems were. However, we worked through it. We got some luck. But, you know, we had a very good picture of sort of, you know, the areas where our guy was probably from. We knew who his distant family members were as the research went on. But, you know, it was just very tricky because of those sort of genealogical type caveats of just, you know, I can't research a family tree if the records aren't there. And if I can't research a family tree, I can't figure out how the matches are related. But again, with a little bit of luck, you know, we had some good breakthroughs.
So in addition to using the database, the crime database, or the criminal database, you're also using databases like Ancestry?
Exactly. Okay. So I get this list from this public DNA site that the state police give me. And it's just, you know, the names of people who are distantly related. So then I have to use other genealogical avenues and sites and, you know, other areas to research their family trees. You know, it's not like I have their family tree on that paper. So if their name is John Smith, I need to try and figure out who that John Smith is. I need to be looking in public records, you know, Facebook, that sort of thing. So it's so much more, you know, than genealogy almost, because it involves a lot of, at least at the start, of researching people who are alive right now, you know, figuring out who the exact person is. You know, if one person on the list is, you know, has a unique name, then, you know, you get a little lucky. But there's so much work that is really involved in building those trees. And that's most of the work, is just trying to create those trees and see those connections and try and see, okay, match one, match four, match five are descended from this group of people. Match two, six, and eight are descended from this group of people. So I call them ancestral couples. So that's what you want to do to start, is just try and identify as many common ancestors and couples as you can, because then you can work downwards. And that's what I was talking about when I was saying casting a wide net.
And so you said that the killer ended up being first generation American. So I assume then you had to go and do research in overseas
exactly. family trees. Exactly. So that's where that issue was I just could not trace these family trees back enough to make those connections. But again, with a little bit of luck and, you know, some DNA hits, we got there. But the prediction did turn out to be pretty much correct. He was, you know, first generation American just about. Three of his grandparents were from Italy, so he was completely Italian. You know, his parents were the first ones born in America. So the prediction was pretty close. But it just goes to show that throughout the process, you can still get a good picture of who the person is, even if you haven't found them yet. Because we're a year and a half in, and I can say, okay, our guy's grandparents probably are this last name. His family is probably from this small town in Italy. You know, his family probably came to Luzerne County around, you know, this time of the year, because that's when a lot of, you know, people with those surnames were coming over. So I don't know if everyone does it that way. That might be a little unique to me, but that's how I see it, is even if you, in the end, you don't get the guy, and thankfully we did here, we still were getting really close to him, and we were getting a genetic picture of who he was.
So how did you ultimately narrow it down of the suspects to Forte?
So what I did was I just worked the matches as hard as I could for as long as I could, which took a lot of time. And in conjunction, of course, pretty much every day with the state police, they were, you know, trying to have people upload DNA to these private or these public sites for our use. You know, people were more than willing to help us. So by going through those matches and getting more DNA and talking to family members of people who we thought were distantly but closely enough related to where they could help us, you know, getting information from them in terms of their family tree, we were sort of able to narrow in more on a specific family that we were looking at. So at the end of the day, what really did it for us was cooperation from these distant but still relatively close family members who, you know, were more than willing to help and provided DNA and uploaded their DNA publicly and that sort of thing. So that allowed us to narrow down the pool. But in the end, we just got a little bit lucky with, you know, a lot of the evidence sort of coming together and the matches came together. Because at the end of the day, we got that big list from, you know, 40 people that I had, this big suspect list in the beginning of the search. You know, we got it down to 4. So I cast a wide net at 40, got it down to 4, and then at the end of the day, all the evidence led right to him.
And did you end up having an actual... Were you able to get a sample of Forte's DNA to compare?
So that's exactly. That's how these cases work, is, okay, we can have it narrowed down to 3-4 people. You know, now if they're alive, get their DNA. If they're deceased, get their kids' DNA, that sort of thing, to prove that, okay, we got them. It's, you know, father-daughter relationship, that sort of thing. With Forte, the interesting thing was, this was the first case I've ever worked on where there was no one to collect DNA. So as things had it, I provided enough evidence for the state police to get, I believe it was a warrant or subpoena to have him exhumed. So my work led to him being exhumed on January 6th of this year. And on February 3rd, it came back that his DNA matched the DNA that was on Maurice's jacket in the amount of septillions. So, you know, there were 24 zeros on the 100%. That he was the man who committed this crime.
Wow. And at that point, I assume before the test was even done, you probably felt pretty confident that he was.
Yeah, so it's so funny because throughout the work and as we sort of narrowed in on, okay, 40 people, 20 people, 10 people, I sort of knew it was him because the evidence was sort of all leading there. And, you know, we found out he had a record, you know, of sexual assault and that sort of thing. So he fit the bill. But what really happened was, you know, we would get a DNA test in that would just, you know, prove, okay, it's got to be him. But it wouldn't be, of course, the septillions of you know, confirmation, because that would require the exhumation. So there were so many steps as we got closer where I was like, all right, it's him, guys. But they'd go, no, let's do another test. You know, so we were so close, and they just kept getting closer and closer and closer because, you know, we wanted to dot every, you know, cross every T, dot every I, and in the end have him exhumed. So we were all pretty confident for a while. But at the end of the day, we wanted to have him exhumed to, you know, show everyone that it was indeed him.
And was he a suspect that police had any strong feelings about before this process started?
So I believe there are 4,000 pages in the Civarella case file.
Yeah, that's what they said. Yeah.
And James Forte's name does not come up in it until I tell the state police his name.
Wow.
Yeah. So that was crazy to me because, you know, they did an incredible job. They worked so hard on this case, you know, and they did so much to have it solved, and it was a great partnership. And they really were so extensive, and to just see that he's like the one person who's somehow not in the file, it just speaks to, I guess, how he sort of got away with it. Is he was just the guy next door that no one thought would do such a thing.
But you said he had a record.
He had a record, but it's funny because, you know, I guess no one really noticed that because, you know, I sort of was told and I was reading online from people who knew him that, you know, they never would have expected this. And we go, all right, well, here's, you know, three newspaper clippings saying he was arrested for this, arrested for that. And, you know, people apparently just thought of him as, you know, that bartender.
What were the crimes again that he was arrested for?
He was arrested for disorderly conduct. I believe he was, chasing someone, running around with a gun. He was arrested in 1974 for indeviate sexual assault. And the woman who he assaulted actually told us when we went back to her and asked her about him that if someone did not come upon them at that time, she told the state police that she thinks he would have killed her. So oh, wow. he clearly had a pattern and a record, but it was just so interesting to see all the documentation for that, as opposed to after his name was released, people just being very surprised by it, because at the end of the day, he was a bartender, and I guess no one really just suspected the bartender living in town.
Yeah. And do you think that, I mean, now that he's dead, obviously you don't know, but is it possible he committed other crimes?
I believe the state police said it's, you know, they think it's not out of the realm of possibility.
Yeah.
I mean, he killed Maurice in 1964. He was arrested in 1974 for that rape. I believe the disorderly conduct was like 1978. So I guess time will tell, but I think he clearly, you know, was a predator.
Yeah. Now, you had mentioned, I think you told the Associated Press, that your work on the case, and I'm going to quote you here, was probably the hardest thing you've ever done in your entire life. Could you tell me more about that?
It really was, and it took me a little bit to come to that realization, just because, you know, when it was all said and done, and I said, okay, you know, how much time did I put into this? You know, I was really working on this for a long time. You know, when people started to ask me that, I thought, oh my gosh, I just worked on this case for pretty much every waking hour of every day for the last 2 years. It just completely consumed me. So that's when I sort of realized that, you know, I think that was probably the most I've ever tried to get something done. That was the hardest thing I've ever had to do. And, you know, I had a great partnership in the state police to do it with.
But obviously it was rewarding.
Extremely rewarding to, you know, get to know her family. And I worked on it for 2 years. And I thought that was the hardest thing I've ever done in my life and, you know, a long time. Her family was waiting 58 years. So, I can't even begin to put myself in their shoes. So to be able to give them that closure was, you know, really important to me and the state police, and it was great.
So were her who were the surviving relatives that you were in touch with?
So her parents are deceased, but her four siblings are all alive. So I've, you know, met with them and talked with them. I just had dinner with her brother this week. So we're, you know, very close. There's a great relationship there. And it's just very rewarding to see that random email I sent from my freshman year dorm one night in Schlosser, you know, turned into solving this case.
Wow. You clearly have a passion for research. And, you know, since this is something you're doing in your free time, in addition to the, you know, research and stuff you have to do for classes, as a librarian, I'm required to ask, no, I'm not required, but I'm going to ask you to share what you enjoy about the research process.
You know, I enjoy, at least in the genealogy side, and I'll touch on all of it, but the genealogy side, you know, I love the hunt. I love finding what I'm trying to find, if it takes me a day, if it takes me a month, if it takes me a year. So that part of it I love. But the general research side of things, I think I just love sort of putting the puzzle pieces together and just being methodical and searching, you know, primary sources, genealogical sources, you know, anything I can find, just scouring everything to get what I need, you know, to have to be able to move on. So I think what I love about the research is being able to put in the work and then being able to see, you know, all right, here's this incredible document, here's this incredible find, you know, that sort of thing are things that I love.
You, as far as I know, you've solved at least two cold cases, two murder cases that were cold cases. Are there more that I'm not aware of?
So I have four solved cold cases on my belt right now, and I'm very honored to have the opportunity to have worked on four. You know, they're, you know, scattered sort of around the country. As of right now, I'm not working on any more. I don't anticipate working on any more. You know, and a lot of them too are ones that I, you know, can't say too much about, but the number's four. Okay. And again, I never would have thought I would have helped solve four cold cases.
And these are all murder cases.
Yeah, so the cases that these can, you know, genetic genealogy can be used for are murder and sexual assault. So all cases are usually, you know, one or the other, or unfortunately a combination of the two.
So these are cases that you solved in, because I know there's maybe two in college. So were there two in high school that you worked
on? My first case actually happened. It was the week I graduated high school. I got reached out to.
Oh, okay.
So that was my first case, and then I had the Chevrella case, and I had a murder case out in Council Bluffs, Iowa, the murder of Lee Gonzalez Rotatori, that I just assisted the Council Bluffs Police Department with. They had already been doing a lot of work. I didn't know they were trying to use genealogy for it, so I reached out and said, if you have any cases, let me know. I'm bored. I'd love to help. And that's what they gave me. And I have an additional case, too, that I can't discuss too much about. So it's certainly been an interesting journey since high school to sort of see this sort of thing that I never thought I would be doing, to sort of, you know, see the results of it.
So you said that you don't plan on doing any more research on these kind of cold cases. Is there a particular reason why?
I mean, I got to finish college. Always my number one.
Yeah.
I mean, as much as I say that, and I've said that for years, I can never stay away. So I'm sure I will have number five very soon. But it's an honor to work on these cases. You know, any opportunity I get to work on a case, I will go for it, because it's an opportunity to provide closure. But as of right now, I'm just trying to focus on school and, you know, move on to the sort of next, not move on, but transition into that sort of post-grad phase.
So what would the post-grad phase, I mean, do you have any interest in a career in something like police work or criminal investigations, or are you more interested in sort of academic research in the future?
Yeah, well, it's funny, because that's the question I'm toying with now, too. And as much as I say, like I just mentioned, you know, that I need a little break, or I should stay away for a little bit from genealogy and the crime stuff, I never can. So I'm sure it will be something that I'm either doing as a job or doing secondary. But as of right now, I'm looking at grad school. I'm looking at MLIS programs, looking at public history programs. So I'm excited to see where that leads. But as of right now, it's certainly a work in progress. And as I always like to say, I think I'll see where the wind takes me.
Yes. Well, that sounds like you've got a good plan. You've got some different options that you're sort of considering. And what has it been like for you dealing with the attention that you've gotten from the media from this case?
Yeah, and I mean, it's something where I totally never expected that. I mean, especially with the Chevrella case. I told my mom this one time. When I was in high school, I was on CBS This Morning, and it was, you know, the first time I was ever on national TV, and it took me a year to put that together. So I was on Good Morning America for the Chevrella case, and I remember calling my mom beforehand, and I said, I'm going down to the conference room to do Good Morning America in my sweatpants. And they emailed me last night. You know, do you remember how it took a year to get on CBS This Morning? So it's almost like at this point I'm just so, I don't want to say used to it, but just so, you know, I'm understanding now that it sort of can come with the territory with these big cases. But I appreciate the opportunity to get the word out there about these cases, because like we said in the beginning, you know, James Forte has been dead for 40 years, but that doesn't stop, you know, me and the state police wanting everyone to know that he's the one who committed this crime. So even though he's not here to pay for it, you know, people who know him and people in the community and around the world now know that that's who did that crime. And I also think it's great to talk in the media about this stuff, because I think it can provide hope to a lot of families who are maybe in a similar situation. But, you know, so that's sort of why I do it. But yeah, the overall attention has been very, very unexpected. But again, it's sort of an honor to be able to talk about my experiences, and, you know, maybe they can inspire someone else too.
So you're fairly comfortable talking to these folks and some of these
I've gotten to that point. There was a time where I was not, but again, I just sort of realized that it came with the territory, and I realized that it was a, you know, it's a great tool to get the word about how great investigative genetic genealogy is out there, and again, to provide hope and inspiration to families.
Oh, that's really interesting. Well, thank you for talking to me today.
Thank you so much, Josh, for the invite.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the J-Pod, a High Library production. I'm your host, Librarian Josh Cohen. Be sure to check back in with us for another episode from the Eatown College community. If you have any ideas for future episodes or feedback, please email me at cohenjp@etown.edu.